Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. I am amazed to announce that this is our 300th show of Cutting the Curd. Our guest is clapping. It was pioneered by Ann Saxelby and now hosted by Greg Blaze and myself. And today, and produced by the amazing Emily Acosta. And today in studio, I'm delighted to welcome a writer and radio show host also, Katie Kiefer, whose book, What's the Matter with Meat, we'll be discussing today. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much, Diane. I'm so glad we're able to talk about my other favorite food group besides cheese. And it seems very appropriate that on your 300th show, we talk about meat instead
right,
of cheese.
Right, we're diverting.
Absolutely.
Enough cheese already.
Yeah. There can never be enough cheese.
That's true. So how does it feel so far to be the interviewee rather than the interviewer in this studio on this show?
Well, it feels great because I never get to talk enough in my own show because I'm actually interviewing somebody else.
Uh-huh.
And even though I'd like it to be all about me all the time, that isn't really what people are tuning in for. So it's thrilling to be on the other side of the interview table, as it were.
Okay. Well, I'll see if I can shut up enough to let you talk.
Yeah, that's right. Don't worry. I'll shut you up.
Okay. First of all, just so that the listeners know, I want to welcome perhaps new listeners to the Cutting the Curd show who might be meat people, meat fans or meat not fans.
That's all right.
Let's see. So the meat topic of today's book is very different. It's, I want to say first, I am a meat eater. I am a meat lover.
Me too.
But I am not fully versed in industrialized meat.
Well, now you are. Because you said you read the book.
I did. But it's a real, you have opened my eyes.
It's an eye opener.
I mean, this is, there's a lot of bad guys in this book.
Well, you know, I want to say that the bad guys are the big industrial meat companies.
Mm-hmm.
They are by no means the people who actually do the raising of meat.
Mm-hmm.
It's the big packers that I think are the villains in this piece because mm-hmm. they are the ones that beat the prices down over and over again for the ranchers and farmers who are raising livestock. Mm-hmm. And so they, I would say, are the ones who bear the most responsibility mm-hmm. for the ways in which we produce meat. Mm-hmm. But that said, I will also say that people want and demand cheap meat in this country. Mm-hmm. And
the whole world, apparently.
And the whole world. Yeah. And that's what these big packers have done. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have realized efficiencies and figured out ways to make meat incredibly cheap. Mm-hmm. And part of the way that they do that is by what they call externalizing the costs. So there are a lot of things that they don't pay for, which any other industry would be obliged to pay for mm-hmm. in terms of environmental impacts. In terms of labor, they mm-hmm. pay very little in terms of labor. So there are a lot of ways that they have managed to sort of, through a kind of marvelous sleight of hand, pushed all of that, those externalized expenses off onto taxpayers, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Producers or taxpayers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they themselves reap these absolutely unbelievable profits. Mm-hmm. I mean, I forget exactly what the figures are, but something like when I was writing the book, I looked up the net profit for the Tyson Company, which produces, of course, all manner of meat. They have mm-hmm. chicken, they have pigs, they have cattle. Mm-hmm. And their profits in for the first quarter of 2015 or something like that was, you know, in the quarter billion dollar range. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an astonishing sum. Mm-hmm. So they could afford to pay, for example, to equip every contract farmer that they work with a means for mitigating the problems with animal waste, which mm-hmm. is by far the most extreme issue that most smaller producers face, mm-hmm. Or these contract farmers. I mean, 50,000 hogs or 20,000 hogs or whatever it is produces a lot of manure, mm-hmm. like a lot, man, 30 pounds per pig at mm-hmm. full market weight mm-hmm. per animal. So that's hundreds of tons per year mm-hmm. that these contract farmers are obliged to dispose of in some way. And frankly, there is no method for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that all of that waste sits in these big lagoons. It pollutes the atmosphere. It can pollute groundwater. It has a whole host of issues. I mean, the gases that are coming off of those lagoons are full of you know, hydrogen sulfide, mm-hmm. ammonia. I mean, mm-hmm. guys die. There are many stories of farmers who, you know, if they
what a death.
I know, right? Oh. But it happens really mm-hmm. fast. You'll mm-hmm. die in a few mm-hmm. minutes. Mm-hmm. From the impact of those gases, if you fall in or you somehow get trapped underneath and you can't get out fast enough. Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few stories about that.
Well, you're going ahead into the content.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's like I told you, I like to talk.
Draw you a little back just for a few questions, because I usually ask my writers, how and when did you start this project? Who approached whom?
Ooh. Actually, Andy Smith, who was my guest today, Andrew F. Smith, who is a very prolific author and a teacher at the New School, mm-hmm. He is the editor of a series called Food Controversies for British Press called Reaction.
Okay.
So actually, he approached Patrick Martins from Heritage Foods USA, and who was mm-hmm. the guy who started this radio station. And Patrick, first of all, doesn't have time to write a book like this, and secondly, doesn't really have the granular information about mm-hmm. industrial meat that I sort of had before I mm-hmm. started the project. Mm-hmm. So he suggested to Andy that he contact me, and that's how it happened.
Okay. How long did it take?
It took about, it took me about 9 months. Mm-hmm. That's including footnotes and bibliography, which mm-hmm. I found excruciating to do.
Oh, but they're well done. Now, has this topic been yours for years?
Yes, it has.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I've always been really interested mm-hmm. in the meat business. And when I first started writing, I was a cook, then I became a publicist. And when my publicity job ended, I started writing for Food Arts Magazine, which is now sadly defunct. Mm-hmm. But they immediately recognized that I was a total meathead. And so every story I wrote for them basically was about meat.
Ah.
And that's kind of how I got interested and how I got to go to a really big meat processor, a Cargill processing plant in mm-hmm. Fort Collins. Mm-hmm. And I met Temple Grandin. She gave me the tour of the plant. Mm-hmm. And I learned a whole lot about industrial processing at that point. Mm-hmm. And then so a few years went by and I began interviewing a lot of guests about the meat industry on my mm-hmm. show. And I was very wound up about antibiotics in the food supply. And mm-hmm. that, of course, is very much the purview of the meat industry.
Right.
So, yeah, this has definitely been a subject I've followed for years.
And have you been a butcher?
I was a butcher, okay. Yeah. I did prepared foods for a little butcher shop on the Upper West Side for about 5 or 6 years. And so, because I was, you know, cook by trade. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really just stand there during the evening rush and not help. When people were asking for a cut-up right. chicken, I couldn't mm-hmm. be like, no, I'm sorry, I only do ratatouille. So they taught me. I mean, I can't break down a cow, uh-huh. but I can probably take apart a pig or a lamb pretty mm-hmm. handily, and I can okay. certainly cut up a chicken very fast.
Okay. So your background in food is as a cook and a butcher yeah.
And a publicist.
Okay. Okay. Now, I just keep thinking in our new political landscape how all of this is just going to get worse in the anti-EPA, pro-business outlook of our, I don't even like to say current administration, but...
I think we could call it the regime.
Okay, okay. The current regime.
Yeah, I think in the current regime.
The hopefully temporary current regime.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Day by day.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I presume you were writing in the midst of the Obama years.
Yes, I was, yeah.
So you were feeling a little more optimistic, I presume, about many of these issues.
Well, you know, the meat industry has, it's a very big ship, and it is hard to turn a big industrial ship like mm-hmm. that. And mm-hmm. the thing that, to give people credit where credit is due, a lot of very positive changes have come in the last decade into the meat industry. And even longer before that, in the 90s, is when, for example, Temple Grandin mm-hmm. began designing more humane handling protocols at the behest of McDonald's, believe it or not.
I saw that in your book.
Yeah,
I didn't know McDonald's could be a good guy.
I know. They're not stupid people who run mm-hmm. these companies. Mm-hmm. And they saw that mishandling animals results in a lesser quality of product in the end. And so it's obvious it's not driven by any great sense of, you know, what's right and what's
right.
wrong.
They
any
want
ethical
their meat
sense.
To taste better.
But they want their meat to taste better. Mm-hmm. And that was one way to do it was to, because when you mishandle animals, they release a lot of stress hormones, and that has an impact on the quality of their flesh.
And particularly, Temple Grandin spoke as a keynote speaker at the cheese conference.
Oh, did she really?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, a couple years ago. And so she talks about how, you know, you don't want the animal scared
right.
before they're killed because that will make them taste worse.
It floods their system with cortisol.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, you know, in humans, that's supposedly what makes us get fat around the middle.
Ah.
So remember that those ads for Relicor?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was supposed to be an anti-cortisol treatment.
Okay.
But anyway, it turns turns beef a very dark, they call it a dark cutter.
Oh, right. I saw that in the book, too.
And for pigs, it either makes their flesh, they call it pale exudative, or it's dark and dry.
So immediate.
Immediate. Oh, this okay. stress hormone floods uh-huh. the muscle tissue, which is what we eat,
mm-hmm.
and it will alter the actual chemistry mm-hmm. and the molecular structure.
So you could do really well raising the animal and then kill it wrong
and then blow
you've
it.
Ruined it.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, I wouldn't
so
say
you
it was
would
ruined,
think
but
how that makes sense in terms of spending money at that juncture to make it taste better.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, you know, that the animal handling protocols that Temple Grandin has devised and has promulgated throughout the industry, particularly the cattle industry, has had, you know, quite a big impact. But as she herself says, you know, you can have the best serpentine maze, you know, thing in the world to get them to the killing box. But if you have somebody who's yelling at them or hitting them or prodding them with an electric prod, you know, it doesn't matter. It's like you can't teach people. There are some people you cannot teach to be good animal handlers.
Mm-hmm.
And because meatpacking is such a, you know, it's a highly stressful, highly dangerous job. It is not well paid, and the people are not well trained. Mm-hmm. And that is a failure of management. Mm-hmm. But that is also why you see those terrible videos of, you know, horrible PETA videos or Mercy for Animals of people mistreating animals. It's, mm-hmm. they cannot control every single person mm-hmm. who handles the animals, and that's where a lot of those videos come from. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know. To their credit, a lot of companies are putting in the third-party audited video cams, and mm-hmm, right. you know they're mm-hmm. trying their best, I think, to mitigate the problem. But it's definitely still an issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to tell some of my cheese listeners some of the facts about this book. It is a very serious book. It is packed with facts. I don't know. You do not mess around.
I don't. You know, it's funny that people say it's a very serious book. I mean, at my book party last week, which you were so nice to come to, a friend of mine was leafing through it. She hadn't read it yet. And she said, wow, this looks so serious. And I just looked at her and I was like, what do you think? I'm just going to write a cartoon? I mean, yeah, it's yeah. serious. Of course. This is a serious business.
Right. Now, who do you think will read it? Is it for students? Is it for economists? Is it for researchers?
I really see it as a book very much for consumers. Mm-hmm. I think that most, I mean, I hope that schools will buy it. Mm-hmm. But I think that most consumers, you know, they have it in their head that there's something wrong with meat. There's something bad about eating meat. You know, there's a lot of guilt tripping around eating meat. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that this book will help them understand what actually is the matter with meat, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. drive them to demand better qualities.
Okay. Oh, shucks, that's my phone. I'm so sorry.
Dear, it sounds like a bird.
Turned it off.
There's a bird.
It's crickets, actually.
Oh, okay.
But I'm sorry about that. But yeah, I think, I mean, I meant it as a primer for mm-hmm. consumers okay. to understand what is this industry and to understand what you're buying into when you buy cheap meat. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that everybody has to rush out to their farmer's market and spend $25 on a chicken. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to think about where it's coming from, to try to support better brands, mm-hmm. to do a little bit of reading up on what brands have a better track record in terms of environmental practices or animal handling protocols or even just, you know, whether mm-hmm. or not they're using a more robust gene pool than mm-hmm. the industrialized meat community mm-hmm. does.
I'm going to tell the listeners a bit about what you cover. First, you have a great chapter on the evolution of industrial meat production. And I was reminded a bit of cheese, which... you know, initially, the industrialization is a good idea. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got high standards, it's got consistency, it's got people are going to make better money, but then it sort of spins out of control.
Yeah.
And downward. And that's what you really capture quite extensively in this book. How that's only the beginning, and then things go from bad to worse. Now, your chapters...
Diane, you're killing me.
Well, your chapters, almost all full of bad news, are, let's see, genetics.
Yeah, that was one of the more interesting chapters to write, actually, mm-hmm. Because everybody knows about animal welfare concerns, you know, mm-hmm. like, I mean, right. I'm sure you're not quite as aware or weren't quite as aware before as you are now.
Right.
But the genetics thing is a very interesting aspect to this, because mm-hmm. if you think about heirloom seeds, mm-hmm. it's sort of the same idea. You don't want to put all of your sort of genetic eggs in one basket, as it were.
But they are doing
that. But they do that. Yeah,
they want to do that to a great extent. Want to do it for price, basically, and
price and uniformity, yeah,
and ease of growing,
absolutely.
Speedy growing, or
yeah.
being happy to be stuffed into a small space,
right? Being able
without
to survive
without pecking each other's lips off,
yeah, yeah. Being able to survive the concentrated area feeding operation, whether yeah. no matter yeah. which breed it yeah. is, does require some special genetic manipulation.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a big chapter, livestock and disease, all on antibiotics and that horror show.
Oh, and
show.
BSE.
And
the
BSE.
Bovine spongiform right? encephalopathy. Right. Yeah, right. right. Mad cow disease.
Right. And then we go into environmental costs, which is the water and waste.
Water, waste, and also The monocropping.
Yes.
Because in order to feed all those animals, which are primarily fed corn and soy, you have to grow great swaths of corn and soy, which is not necessarily the best thing for the land.
Right, which is not something the meat eater or thinks about. Like, where are all these animals getting fed from?
Right, absolutely.
I mean, just, you know, this is how your book connects the dots in a really interesting way.
Mm, thank you. Love that.
And then we go to, let's see, wages and workers and safety, and they're in bad shape.
Oh, yeah, the meatpacking industry.
They're not being paid, they're not being trained, and they're, you know, going to kill themselves with knives.
Yeah, and they and repetitive injury.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, more bad
repetitive
news.
Motion industry injury.
Katie, which of these areas need the most uncovering, do people not know about, and which need the most change, if you could select?
I would say labor. Mm-hmm. I think people should be much more aware of food workers in general, whether it's farm or, you know, meat packers, you know, farm workers, meat packers, food workers up and down the chain are among the worst paid, least compensated in terms of health care, in terms of paid leave, in terms of medical care, all of those things.
Even though they're going to be injured.
Oh, yeah.
And need it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in meatpacking, that's one of the most dangerous jobs in the country, in any country. Okay. I think it's not the top five, but it's the top seven, I think. Mm-hmm. It is one of the most dangerous because of the knives, obviously, mm-hmm. because of these giant machines that they're operating, mm-hmm. the big bandsaws, the grinders. I mean, people still disappear into grinders.
Oh, yeah. That was a scary. I remember when I worked at Murray's, we used to be somewhat preoccupied with the pictures of the fingers flying off on the meat slicer.
Oh, yeah.
Like the warning picture. And that's nothing compared to falling into a meat grinder.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Death.
Yeah, you're
death.
All done.
Okay, we have to take a break.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com. And as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hi. Hi, Diane Stemple back with Katie Kiefer on What's Wrong with Meat?
What's the matter with
What's
meat?
What's the matter with meat? Oh my gosh.
That's okay. It's all right.
And
<It's> all
right. keep telling me.
I'm going to have to leave now.
Keep telling me what's the matter with meat. So what was the second thing you were
saying? So the second
saying?
Thing I wanted to say was, in addition to improving the lot of meat workers, I also think that people should be more aware of the environmental impacts of meat production, just because, and I can't remember whether I've already said this on this program, but basically meat producers, these big packing companies who basically own, there's only four in each category, essentially. And some of them overlap. You know, it's Tyson, it's Cargill, it's JBS, it's National Beef, it's Purdue, Sanderson, you know, those people. Anyway, a lot of these guys work with their contract farmers in a way that is really detrimental to the farmer. And as I said before, the whole issue of disposing of waste is really a huge one. And it has a tremendous impact on the surrounding communities. And really, these companies should be regulated the way that other industries are regulated in terms of their environmental impacts. And so I'm not saying that these farmers who are barely making it should be the ones who install air scrubbers or anaerobic digesters over their, you know, poop lagoons. But that's what needs to happen. And they should be getting assistance from these companies to make that work for them. These companies are walking away with huge profits, and they are doing it on the backs of these farmers. And really, the farmers need help in managing these issues. So that, to me, is the other thing that people should really be aware of. And then the fact that we're monocropping too much, and that we are basically, I mean, the ultimate point of this book is to make the case that eating as much meat as we are projected to do over the next, you know, 35 years until 2050, when our population exceeds 9 billion, we simply cannot grow enough corn and soy to feed the livestock and also grow crops for human consumption. So what we're doing now is we're growing these products like corn and soy that often go into biofuels as well as animal feed. And there's no space left, no arable land left on which to grow the crops that actually humans
and
eat.
And even if everyone cooperates, we'll run out of space.
That's correct. And what's happening is that these companies like Cargill, for example, there's a whole section on land grabbing. And that's something that I think is sort of part and parcel of this whole environmental talk. And that land grabbing is a situation where a country like, say, the United States will go into an African country or a South American country, and they will buy up hundreds of thousands of acres of land on which to grow corn and soy.
For now or for later?
For now or for later. Sometimes they start farming it right away, and sometimes they just sit on the land as an investment. But whatever the reason that they're, whatever their plans for it, it means that many of the indigenous people, the local people, are then basically shut out of the land on which they grow food. And so this creates a lot of instability and civil unrest, and that should really be curtailed as well.
And this isn't, this is thinking about population growth more than global warming.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, global warming is also going on simultaneously.
Absolutely.
And that's not, you know, water is disappearing and all sorts of things are happening.
This is having an impact on water supplies.
Yeah.
In fact, I just finished an article for the New Food Economy about land grabbing, quote unquote, in the United States. And people are not aware of how much land we sell in this country to other countries. And it's not by any means a sort of dangerous proposition until you start thinking about water. Because some of the land that's being sold, for example, the Saudi Arabians bought a whole bunch of land in Arizona and Southern California in the last couple of years to grow alfalfa for their dairy herds. They don't have enough water in Saudi Arabia to grow a crop like that, but they don't really have enough water in Southern California and Arizona to do it either. And so that sale in particular, for example, has, you know, some people welcome these buyers in and they say, oh, it's great for the local economy. It brings more jobs, blah, blah, blah. But other people are saying, hey, wait a minute. my well just went dry.
Right.
I have to dig deeper to get more water. They're taking our resources. And this is where I feel like Americans need to be a bit more aware of those kinds of sales. Like when we sold the Smithfield Company, when Smithfield was bought by the Chinese in 2013, they didn't just buy one out of every four pigs growing in the United States. They bought over 400 farms. And that's hundreds of thousands of acres that, because Smithfield is a vertically integrated company, they grow the feed for all their pigs. So this means that we are selling not just the pigs, but we have sold the water and we have sold the farmland.
And does anyone even pay attention to that headline?
You know, that sale got quite a bit of scrutiny.
Okay. But it I don't remember it.
It did ultimately pass.
Was it on in the business section?
No. Well, it was, and but it was also written up in a lot of yeah, it was definitely on the front page. First of all, it was the largest land sale I think that the United States has ever participated in. It took a lot of scrutiny from both the CFIUS, which is the Council for International I can't remember what the acronym means. But anyway, it's an organization that does look at foreign acquisitions of American companies. And they passed it. And also the, you know, the agricultural committees passed it. I mean, it went through a lot of hoops to make it work. But one thing that struck me when I was researching again for this land grabbing story is at the time of the sale, the CEO of Smithfield, a guy named Larry Pope, he said, hey, there's nothing to worry about here. It's just one company buying another company. It's part of globalization. But the reality is that the company that acquired Smithfield was then sold to another company called the WH Group, which has very close ties to the Chinese government. So, in fact, the company Smithfield is now really sort of with one or two degrees of separation being run by the Chinese government.
And what percent of Smithfield is pork? Because the Chinese love pork.
Yes, absolutely. Smithfield, so it's an all pork company.
Yeah, they need pork.
Yeah, and they are out of arable land, and they are pretty much out of potable water, partly because of the fact that they have adopted American livestock agriculture models. And this is being adopted all over the world. That's why I wrote this book, because the book, I should say, covers five major production areas. It's the United States, Brazil, the UK, the EU, the European Union, which includes, at the time, it included the UK, and then Australia and Asia, Asia being primarily China. But China is doing a ton of land grabbing as well. They're buying up huge swaths of Africa in order to grow crops for their livestock.
I just saw someone I know out there.
Oh, how exciting.
Person, a cheese person. Anyway, okay, so I have a couple questions. What small percent, like, in the food world, in the little food world at Heritage, we're thinking about the meat hook and Heritage Foods and all the fancy high-priced meat that we want to eat. What percent of meat is the fancy meat?
That's a great question. I would say probably less than 1%.
Yeah. So it's really not making
any difference. I wouldn't say that. I would say that it's actually making a lot of difference because as more companies like, for instance, Nyman Ranch or, I don't know, Snake River Beef or, you know, some of the better brands are raising people's awareness that there is another type of product to buy. And the more that people know that there are other options out there, that they can get a better value, that they are buying into values because people buy a lot based on their values. The more that people are aware of those options and the more that they support those businesses, the more that forces the big guns to alter some of their practices.
And indeed, to take note.
And they do. I mean, all of the animal handling stuff, all of those videos from, you know, PETA and Mercy for Animals, that had a huge impact on how they managed their animal handling welfare and welfare concerns.
Okay.
That really did make a difference. And again, with the whole issues around antibiotics and the food supply, they have had to respond to consumer demands. They've responded to consumer demands about cage-free eggs, about crate-free veal, about farrowing crates and gestation crates. I mean,
but
these
it
are
seems
big
like in your
driven.
Book, it talks about how they sort of then cheat.
They can, and
you know,
do.
They'll say they have so many inches, but it's really not very many inches per chicken.
Well, I think that there's a lot of marketing terms that are quite misleading to the public. For the word natural, for example, which means absolutely nothing.
Right. It means maybe alive. This chicken was alive.
Right. It's not a rubber chicken. But, you know, so stuff like that, there is a bit of deliberate misleading of the consumer, I think, by marketing companies because it's just expedient. It's cheaper. And indeed, I mean, when people say that they have a free range chicken, that chicken can maybe go outside into a little yard, you know, like that runs along the big chicken house. There might be a place for him to go out and, you know, but it's not as if these chickens are like on Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm, you know, following the sheep around pastures and, you know, eating bugs. I mean, that
plucking
is not what's happening.
And,
pecking. This is not happening. And there's been a lot in the news lately about organic really not being organic. There was the big organic milk thing that just happened a few weeks ago that got a lot of press, where it was turned out the cows were being fed GMO corn and that didn't really meet the organic standards, you know. So, I think these labels make it hard for people to really understand what they're buying. And so that's one reason to really sort of look up a company and look at what they're doing and who they're working with. I mean, I love to go back to Niman Ranch again and again because this is a company that has about 800 farms working for them. And they have a model and a distribution system that has succeeded on an industrial scale, but the animals are well cared for, and you know they've got their own slaughtering protocols and their own slaughterhouses and stuff like that. So they're, you know, they've really walked the walk, and they guarantee their farmers a certain level of income, as opposed to other hog farmers who were working under contract for something like a Smithfield or a Tyson, where those contracts can change from, you know, cycle to cycle, where they don't know what they're going to get paid per pound. They don't, you know, it's up to the company to decide, the aggregator. And the farmers are really quite helpless under that kind of system. And that's one reason why I think the whole contract farming thing needs to be revisited by.
Now, can you explain to our audience what the CAFO model is? Because I feel like that's really important here.
Well, CAFO is a concentrated area feeding operation. I think typically people think about that as cattle. Are you asking about the cattle model? So cattle actually have a much better life than hogs or chickens. Because cattle go through three stages, and the cattle industry has not consolidated, has not been able to consolidate their operations the way that poultry and pigs have.
Is that because they're bigger?
The animals are bigger, and they require different environments as they're growing out, and they take longer than the other animals as well. So typically in a cattle operation, you have the cow-calf. That's where the cow gets bred. It's almost always artificial insemination. She has her calf, and the calf stays with the mom for quite a while. And then, at about 6-9 months, they're moved on to what's called a stocker feeder. And that's a pasture-based system. Obviously, in the winter, they're not going to be out grazing on pasture, but you know, they're more or less outside. They have shelter, but they're still, you know, they're living like cattle, like what you expect, you know, cows to be. And then the last couple of months, typically cattle are slaughtered around 13 to 16 months. And so at that point, that's when they'll go into what people think of as the concentrated area feeding operation. That's that is the feed lot. And that's where they're aggregated into pens. And they are, you know, there's a long, long trough that will go the length of the pen. And the animals are all hooked up to that to eat. And they're fed a lot, you know, at certain times of the day they get fed. And they're kind of packed in there. There are laws on the books that dictate how much space a cow has to have around them, but the reality is that cows are herding animals. They like to be close together. So in a way, unless it's a really horrible feedlot where the animals are really dirty and they're really, really packed in there. I've seen a few of them. They're not that bad, frankly.
Okay, that's interesting. So cows are...
Of the three big food groups, they get the best. Respect. Yeah, they are. You know, it's by no means a perfect situation. But, you know, in general, I would say compared to poultry and pigs, oh, my God, it's night and day. Mm. In my opinion, pigs are the most abused animals on the planet. A pig, a full-grown pig, has roughly the intellectual capacity of a three-year-old child. I have seen pigs. I've seen videos of pigs
learning. They're that smart.
Yes. Ah. I have seen them learn how to operate a joystick and play a game on a computer. Not kidding.
Wow.
Yeah. No, they are really smart.
Oh.
So
then one can assume they're suffering more.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm. They're incredibly sentient. They're very social. Mm-hmm. They're very curious. They need a lot of stimulation. Mm-hmm. And what happens to pigs is, first of all, they're, you know, the babies are taken away from mom quite early. They're weaned very early, like 2 to 3 weeks. Which is bad for their health, which is what contributes to the abuse of antibiotics, because if they wean the pigs too early, they don't get as much natural immunity. Mm-hmm. So then they have to inoculate them with a lot of antibiotics, and they give them vaccines and probiotics. I mean, the antibiotic issue is sort of being resolved, but not really in this country. Other countries are way ahead of us in that. The Danish, for example, and the Dutch are miles ahead of us in terms of figuring out how to raise animals in confinement without using all those antibiotics. But anyway, I digress. And then they're just like packed into these pens, and, you know, they are freaking smart and they need something to do. And one of the things that I talk about in terms of like industrial practices that the industry considers totally humane, which would appall anybody else, is they dock their tails. They'll cut their tails off because when the pigs have nothing to do, they turn on each other.
Right.
And they become very aggressive. And it's the same thing with chickens. Chickens do the same thing. They will peck other chickens to death. And that is very common. And again, this is because, first of all, they're social. They're packed into these small spaces. Their social hierarchies are constantly disrupted and altered.
They're mad.
And they're unhappy. So, you know, they talk a lot about cage enrichment for chickens. They talk a lot about, you know, things that you can do for pigs that will keep them entertained. And a couple of years ago, I was working for a guy
Is that like enrichment in education?
Yeah. Well, for pigs, it's like putting a bale of straw into their pen and letting them play with it.
Oh, right. I read that.
Or giving them a ball. Yeah, I mean, they're unbelievably destructive, these animals. I mean, they can be.
I have one more question before we have to end. How come the EU is so much better than we are? Is there an answer to that question? Every chapter you mention, well, in the EU, it's better. Well, in the EU, it's better.
It is.
And will it continue to be better?
No, it won't. The more that they adopt American methods, the farther away they get from having smaller farms producing their animals for you know, for livestock purposes.
But they seem like their belief system is better.
Oh yeah,
to begin with.
I mean, the UK got highest marks in animal welfare. I forget what the name of the organization was that I looked up at it, but I know I put this in one of the chapters, like there is this organization that measures welfare standards, and they, you know, did it for 50 different countries. And then they explained like the results. So for example, the Russians, as you might imagine, have literally no concern for animal welfare. It's like not even on the radar. They couldn't care less. Whereas the UK, the French, the Dutch, the Danish, they're all deeply involved in making sure that their animals are happy and well cared for. And part of that is because of the tradition of small farming. You know, the Nyman Ranch pigs, not to give them too much of a free commercial here, but they, it's the same kind of thing. They have smaller farms. And so the animals, or even Heritage Foods USA is another place where I visited a lot of small pig farms. And the pigs are, they love their farmers, you know, they know them.
And the farmers love
And the farmers back. Love the pigs. In fact, I sat next to a pig farmer one time and I said, would you ever... would you ever visit New York? And he said, only if I can bring my pigs.
More than one?
Yeah. I just thought that was fabulous. He loves his pigs. That's mm-hmm. why he got out of industrialized farming. Mm-hmm. He was like, mm-hmm. I couldn't do what they were telling me to do. Mm-hmm. So I quit.
Well, thank you very much for coming
Thanks
on the show.
For having
it's been
me,
a
Diane.
Pleasure talking about meat and what's the matter with it.
That's right.
and this is our 300th show. We're celebrating. Let's go have some drinks.
Absolutely.
And it's Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities, and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.